But this is the first time that we've had two of the three presidential candidates pandering to Bitcoiners. We are getting to the point where politicians need Bitcoiners, but Bitcoiners don't necessarily need politicians. But obviously there were some missions that were more critical than others if or when we got into a kinetic fight. Patriotism could not be higher than it was on September 12th. You fast forward over the next 20 years, for me, there starts to be a little bit of estrangement and delusionment where I start to lose sight of what we're really doing.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Wave podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. I just finished a fantastic conversation with Adrian Cercenia, who is a former military cybersecurity expert. This guy's got quite a story, and we talked about a lot of things. We talked about his background in the military, his experience there, what led him to cybersecurity, some of his tips and tricks and best practices on that front. But we also talked a lot about a lot of the assault on free speech that we've seen in recent weeks and months, and some of the tools that he is using and considering as he thinks about censorship-resistant options. And we're fortunate to live in an age where some of those are becoming available, Bitcoin, of course, being the monetary use case for free speech. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Adrian here. Adrian, on short notice, man, you came through for me. We kind of had a mix up on some things, delays on some other podcasts. So I really appreciate you joining the show today. You've been on my radar to discuss some things with anyway. So I'm glad we get to do this sooner than later.
Yeah. Well, hey, Michael, I'm really excited to be on the show. Thanks for thinking of me. And, you know, I love talking about Bitcoin and freedom technology. So this is a great opportunity, especially since it's been top of mind recently with a lot of the news that I think we'll jump into here later.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's, man, so much to cover. We've been putting out some content on it, but I'm glad we'll have the opportunity to go in a bit more detail and hear some outside perspectives on it. Before we jump into that, and I'm going to want to hear your background, and it's an interesting one. We had the opportunity, of course, to meet in Nashville at the Bitcoin conference. And before we jump in, I wanted to hear your thoughts on the experience, what you thought of the event more generally.
Yeah. You know, I thought it was an amazing opportunity and probably a once in a lifetime event as far as timing wise goes, right? You know, previous conferences, there's always signal and there's always, you know, a ton of information, great people to learn from. But this is the first time that we've had two of the three presidential candidates pandering to Bitcoiners. And so I found that absolutely fascinating. You know, we are getting to the point where politicians need Bitcoiners, but Bitcoiners don't necessarily need politicians. So it's a pivotal point. And I think we're going to look back on it and say, hey, this is potentially one of the times where there was a massive shift, not only in the Overton window, but as far as, you know, legitimacy, acceptance in the public's eye of Bitcoin. You know, we've been fighting Bitcoin, or Bitcoiners have been fighting, you know, over a decade of negative news, whether it's, you know, been called a Ponzi or a scheme or a scam or any of these other things. And so all of this culminating in Nashville, I think really brings a lot of legitimacy to the entire industry.
Yeah, I completely agree. It was, you know, I think there was a lot of political pandering, obviously, and that's kind of the complaint of a lot of Bitcoiners. And, you know, don't rely on your local politician or your national politician to be your savior. But I think, yeah, the Overton window shifting, and this is becoming, it's fair game for discourse now, where, yeah, the last decade, it just, you know, it's one thing after the next. It uses too much energy. It's, you know, it's a Ponzi, it's whatever. And the fact that people are speaking about it openly at a Bitcoin conference in a positive light, I think is, I think it's indicative of where we've come. So, yeah, I think I share the same sentiment. Any comments you know, we were talking offline, you got to meet some people in real life who I think you've been in touch with a while. How did that go?
You know, I was going to say, if we're going to jump to another topic, I wanted to kind of anchor down on that. I think that's one of the best things about the Bitcoin conference in Nashville, as well as just Bitcoin conferences in general. I encourage a lot of people who've been in the space for a while, whether or not they're a lone wolf kind of, you know, Bitcoining on their own, or, you know, they stay within their circle of a local meetup. But I encourage people to kind of break out of that and, you know, go to a conference, feel the energy, get an opportunity to talk to, you know, the people that you might see on a podcast. I thought it was great for me to see. I was at one of the side events, and I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with Checkmate for a little bit. Unbeknownst to me, I mean, the dude is like a giant. He's like 6'5", I think, and you know, I'm pushing 5'6" when I'm in shoes. So it was definitely a surprise to me, but really just to take that opportunity to talk to folks in real life, you know, as Bitcoiners on Bitcoin Twitter or, you know, pivoting over to Noster, a lot of us have built these connections and these relationships virtually, but doing it in real life just takes it to an entirely different level. So I love the energy of Bitcoin conferences. And even though there was like 20 or 30,000 people there, there's still an opportunity to, you know, make those really great personal connections at the conference. And if that's too many people for folks, I encourage people to, you know, possibly check out one of the other smaller conferences. Yeah, maybe there's a little bit more signal and a little bit less noise with events like that. But I would never recommend somebody to not go to a conference.
Yeah. Yeah. Even you and I just standing there in the lounge got to snag a few people, met Gary Cardone briefly, saw Michelle Weekly, other people walking around. It's just fun to, you begin to like put a personality with the faces that you've been seeing online for a long time. And it's a lot of fun. So, well, good. I'm glad the conference was as fruitful for you as it was for me. Let's talk about you a bit. So start with your background. So until relatively recently, I think, you were in the military. You have a background in cybersecurity, which is near and dear to the hearts of us folks at the Bitcoin Way. Could you share, what led you into the military, into cybersecurity specifically, and, what some of your takeaways from that experience were?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually going to flip that over, just because it aligns a little bit better. So what led me into cybersecurity, and people out there will probably laugh. But we'll go back. I'm a little bit older than most people think. So this was like in the mid 1990s. And what led me to cybersecurity was actually AOL. For the older folks in the audience, they might remember you had those AOL discs and, you know, you put it into your disk drive and you had 25 hours free on the internet. And so I took every opportunity to grab a disk every time and come up with, you know, a fake persona to be able to get my free 25 hours. During that time, I stumbled across a couple of different groups in chat rooms and in forums, and really kind of started to delve into the darker areas of AOL and the internet. Got into phishing accounts on AOL at a very early age, and then getting access to different email accounts and accounts to be able to get online. And so that's what really led me towards cybersecurity was, for me, it was just that exploration. You know, you're a young high school kid exploring this new thing called the internet. And then along the way, you start to discover different things, started to teach myself how to program. And so that's kind of what led me into the path of cybersecurity. And then funny enough, you know, a couple of years later, I go to college and I went to the United States Air Force Academy. And based on that experience in high school, I knew I wanted to go get a computer science degree. And I think it was like my second class in the computer science department. And it was related to, let's call it Uniform Code of Military Justice. Most people with military ties would understand that as UCMJ. And the UCMJ and the intersection of cybersecurity. And it was like eye-opening and kind of scary for me to realize, hey, a lot of this stuff that I've been doing is now prosecutable. And so really it's like, hey, take that black hat off and, you know, really pivot towards more of a gray hat and eventually towards a white hat. And that's what led me down the path. So I ended up getting my undergrad in computer science 4 years later and then commissioning into the United States Air Force. Did the majority of my time in information technology and cybersecurity. And so I'll kind of pause there if there's anything you want to dive a little bit deeper on.
Yeah. I'm curious what that looks like in the military. Like, you know, I worked in, I was always in sales. I never, my graduate degree is in cybersecurity management, but I was never a practitioner. And, I sort of have this view of like, you know, corporate cybersecurity, compliance, like all these components. What exactly are you doing in the U.S. military? And I know there are a range of hats you can wear, but for you specifically, like what was your day to day? What problems were you trying to solve?
Sure. So there's definitely an evolution of it over the course of 21 years in the military. When I was younger as a first lieutenant or as a second lieutenant and a junior captain, a lot of that was primarily focused on information technology, service delivery to folks. We're talking about in the Air Force, we're talking about the warfighters who are the pilots. Being able to enable their mission was the primary focus. Later on, we started to pivot away from, you know, an ISP like service delivery and more to defending that network and identifying critical paths within the network that are the most important and what we want to defend the most. And as I progressed in rank, obviously that meant that I was more hands off keyboard and leading the next generation of troops who were on keyboard. And like you said, whether that's compliance, whether that's a vulnerability index on, you know, what needs to be patched on a particular machine, what is the current state of routers and switches, and what is the critical path of each of those routers and switches, what type of loss can we accept while being able to continue that mission, and then who are the primary mission owners, not to talk down to any particular career field. But obviously there were some missions that were more critical than others when we got into a kinetic fight.
Yeah. So the higher you elevated in rank, the broader your what you would oversee became. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah. So as a commissioned officer in the Air Force, and later I pivoted to the Space Force for other reasons. But ultimately, as a commissioned officer, you know, your tradecraft is a lot of leadership. The more senior you get, you know, when you're a young officer, you have that opportunity. Obviously, you're still leading people, but you have an opportunity to get hands-on and get a little bit more technical. But the Air Force and the Department of Defense does not want to pay, you know, a major or a lieutenant colonel to be hands-on keyboard. They want to be able to utilize you to be able to speak that technical language, translate that, whether it's down to the technicians who are hands on the keyboard or translate it up to the colonels and the general officers so that they can understand the ramifications, the first order and the second order effects of the decisions that they're about to make.
Okay. So I've got a few questions that come from that. I guess the first is just sort of broadly, how would you describe and rate, so to speak, your experience in the military, in the Air Force?
You know, I almost feel like this is a trick question, but there are many facets of it. So I commissioned in 2002. And the timing of that is important. I started at the Air Force Academy in 1998. So obviously there was a pivotal moment, right in the middle. And that was September 11th, right? And patriotism could not be higher than it was on September 12th. I had already signed my name to the dotted line. I knew where I was going less than a year after that had happened. And so I was already on that trajectory and on that path. And the events on September 11th changed that completely. You know, when I started off, we were focused on near peer adversaries and threats. We were coming out of the Cold War, and all of a sudden it pivots and it changes, and we're looking at counterinsurgency and terrorists. And so that changed a lot. You fast forward over the next 20 years, and there starts to be a little bit, for me, there starts to be a little bit of estrangement and delusionment, and where I start to lose sight of what we're really doing. And so I'll table that, and I'll really pivot into a more positive note. My 21 years in the military, I would never, ever give that up or even wish to go back on it. The people, the relationships, are the best, absolute best part of my military career. A lot of the friends that I've made are my closest friends. My kids call them uncle or auntie. They look to them, and I hope that they provide an example of what good relationships and what healthy relationships look like between adults and adults and friends. And so, yeah, I would never try to go back on it. But it was one of those that, just like any relationship, there's ups and downs and there's roller coasters. But I thoroughly enjoyed my time in the military and I would never go back on it.
Yeah. So we hear a lot about cybercrime, cyber terrorism. They're sort of it's the new flavor of kinetic warfare, is this more passive, insidious. I'm curious, with an $800-900 billion military budget, how do you view the U.S. in particular as ranking? Is like, are we state of the art? Are we on top of the sort of this brave new world in which we find ourselves? Are we prepared for cyber warfare, so to speak, and in a meaningful way? I mean, I imagine we're much further than many countries, but you know, with adversaries like China and so forth, is that something that you you feel confident as you retired and pass the baton along to the next group?
Yeah, I think so. I'll take this from two avenues of approach, right? Number one, from a technical perspective, I think that the U.S. military and the U.S. as a whole is absolutely prepared for some sort of increased tempo conflict in cyberspace. Kind of the other avenue of approach is, are we ready from a senior political civilian decision maker perspective, right? And I'll look through the lens of like a Vietnam or, you know, fighting that counterinsurgency fight. There were opportunities in both of those conflicts to absolutely decimate the adversary, right? But there were also many situations where, you know, self-imposed handcuffs were placed on those capabilities to be able to limit the collateral damage. And so will we see something like that in a large scale conflict in cyberspace? I don't know. Unfortunately, in the United States, the regime changes very often, whether it's, you know, the presidential election cycle that we're in now or the midterms. There's always a constant churn in, you know, the political leadership, and rightfully so. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. You know, we need fresh ideas and we need fresh people to be able to bring those different perspectives into the political landscape. But ultimately, does that hold us back? Are we going to, in some future conflict, are we going to handcuff ourselves again and then get into a longer protracted type of conflict?
So it's not so much the technical or the physical capability, but rather the will to, in the political ability to execute properly and efficiently. Is that sort of what you're hinting at?
Yeah. I mean, I think will is part of it. The other thing about politicians is, right, wrong, indifferent, a lot of them often look to the future. They may not think about the problems that the people are experiencing today, but always, if it's not top of mind, it's certainly back of the mind for them on, you know, what are their chances look like for reelection in the next 2 years or in the next 4 years. And the decisions they make, you know, we talk about incentives a lot in Bitcoin. And if they are incentivized to make decisions that support their reelection versus making decisions that support the present, whether that's a conflict or what's better for the people, I think those incentives are misaligned for politicians very often. And the people that suffer the most are, you know, the constituents, the people who ended up voting for a particular person into office only to be lied to or felt like they're lied to because those promises during the campaign were never delivered.
Okay. So you've mentioned Bitcoin a few times. Why don't you give your Bitcoin origin story? When did you find Bitcoin? And, I think when we spoke, it was in the midst of your service in the military, and we'll talk a little bit about what you're doing now with Bitcoin Veterans. So give us a background. When did you find Bitcoin, and what brought you there?
Yeah. So like I shared with you in Nashville, Bitcoin actually crossed my desk while I was in uniform way back in 2011. We were doing a little bit of analysis on, you know, the dark web and, you know, preferred medium of exchange on the dark web. And obviously, that was Bitcoin. And so I kicked myself for not doing more research on the topic, but I took a look at it and I was like, okay, there's this, what everybody calls funny internet money. And I was like, okay, that's cool. That's interesting. But only criminals use it. Right. And when I was in the military, every couple of years, I had to go through a security background check to be able to access, you know, classified, higher than classified, or secret, higher than secret information. And this is one of those things I was like, well, I'm not touching this with a 10-foot pole. And so I kind of forgot about it for a long time. And then you fast forward to 2016, and the military decided that, hey, we need you to go to Tallinn, Estonia, out there in Eastern Europe. And, you know, I saw my first Bitcoin ATM there. And then in my interactions with the Estonian military and Estonian government, it was absolutely fascinating to me to see that they used, and air quote, they used a blockchain technology for their presidential elections. And they used blockchain technology for their medical care system. And, you know, after learning this, I was like, oh, hey, what was that thing called? Bitcoin. And so that's when I started to really, you know, study Bitcoin. Unfortunately for me, that was also during a, you know, peak shitcoin ICO era. And so I started with Bitcoin, and then I quickly pivoted to Ethereum and all kinds of other shitcoins. You know, you fast forward to 2018 and the bear market there, and I really lost my ass to the tune of multiple digits. And so I really went back to the drawing board at that point and said, hey, what makes all of these other shit coins shitty? Okay. What are the unique aspects that make Bitcoin interesting? And so I really went back to the drawing board, started reading different books. There weren't nearly as many podcasts back then, but trying to consume everything I could, whether it was Austrian economics, having a better understanding of monetary policy, ended up discovering Andreas Antonopoulos, ended up reading the Bitcoin Standard. And as you know, and as your listeners know, you start to really go down that rabbit hole. And, you know, years later, here I am, and I still haven't found the end of it. So it's definitely a journey, but that's kind of, you know, my Bitcoin story, short version.
Did you share your interest in Bitcoin with folks you were serving with? I mean, did anyone know about this? Or was this like a totally private, you were just kind of learning on the side sort of operation that you had going?
It's kind of like meet the parents, right? If you remember, there was like, he talks about the circle of trust, and they're like concentric circles of trust. For me, the people that knew my interest and my passion for Bitcoin were in the innermost circles of trust. I didn't talk about it with many of my coworkers. Some of them I did. But really it was mostly, you know, this lone wolf guy operating in stealth, just interested in Bitcoin and trying to learn as much as I possibly could. And it wasn't until I finally separated from the military that I came out of stealth mode, so to speak, and really started being a lot more active on social media about Bitcoin. For those years prior to that, I was like, you know, creeper lurker guy on Bitcoin Twitter, reading only, never liking anything, just because I know the tentacles can run deep, and I didn't want there to be that much association with me and with Bitcoin. But once I was able to hang up the uniform is really when I decided, hey, let's focus on the most important thing in the world. And for me, that's Bitcoin. You know, we talk about it a lot, but a lot of the problems in this world are downstream of money. And if we can fix the money, then we can start to fix everything that's wrong with the world. Unfortunately, we can't fix everything, but it's definitely the first couple steps on that path.
Yeah. Have you had the opportunity to share Bitcoin in more detail with former coworkers, you know, friends, some of these guys who you said are, you know, still very much involved in a part of your life. Have you orange pilled anyone or had any luck converting anyone to the light?
I have. I doubt she'll ever see this, but when I was in squadron command, and it happened to be kind of during COVID. And so I remember because it was April of 2020. And you know, I'd been grooming her and mentoring her because she had an interest to pivot into a different area of service in the Air Force. And she ended up buying a whole coin just off the bat back in April based on our conversations. And it was funny to see because don't quote me on it, but I think it was around 4 or 5K for one whole coin in April of 2020. And then, you know, you fast forward to like October of 2021, and she calls me. So I've since moved to an entirely different state, and she calls me and she was like, "Hey, this thing is worth way more." And I was like, nodding my head, "Yeah, it is." And she said, "What do you think I should do?" And I was like, "Well, now you have it. Have you studied it?" Right. And she says, "Well, not really. I really just bought it because you kept talking about it." I was like, "Okay, well, I encourage you to study it. Take like a month and just, you know, look for resources. If you want recommendations, let me know." And I told her, "Don't do anything with it. Don't," like, she had just come back from a deployment. I said, "Don't sell it. You're a single captain in the Air Force. You just got back from deployment. You got that tax-free deployment money. I know you don't need the money, so don't sell it. Do some homework, spend a month, don't sell it, and then call me back." The closure to that story is that she didn't sell it, and she's actually started to accumulate a little bit more since then. And then where it stands right now, I'm not sure. We've kind of lost touch since then.
I'd be interested to hear where she's at today.
Yeah.
She probably has a good stack if she studied it hard enough.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about, you said you got to meet some of the guys from the Bitcoin veterans guys in Nashville for the first time in real life. Maybe talk a little bit about, I know you're not day to day involved, but a little bit about the organization and the mission and what it is that excites you about that opportunity.
Yeah. So I'll actually go back to BitBlock Boom 2023. You know, it was the first day. It was probably like the workshop day, and I was just walking around, flying solo by myself, and I see this dude who's he's a big dude, well put together, and we just ended up striking up a conversation, and it turns out it was Shane Hazel, and he's one of the founding members of the Bitcoin Veterans. And, you know, we discovered very quickly, you know, his time in the Marines and all of the badass stuff that he's done, both in his career in the military as well as afterwards. And then he said, "Hey, you know, I think you'd be a good fit to join this group that we're slowly starting to put together." And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely. Let me check it out." And once I got that peek behind the curtain and really come to understand, you know, this core group of former military guys who have adopted Bitcoin into their lives and found it to be an extension of part of the reason why they joined the military and their service, and how they've discovered that through Bitcoin, it absolutely resonated with me. Like, after I got out of the military, there was some periods of time where, you know, there's a little bit, like I said earlier, of estrangement with you know, the direction and the vision that the military is going, and, you know, some disillusionment for me. And then I come to find this group of guys who still believe in freedom, still believe in sovereignty, personal rights, you know, doing the work yourself. And that really kind of lit a fire in me to really support this group of veterans who are finding purpose and vision and a reason to continue to advance freedom in the world through Bitcoin. And so, yeah, it's what started off with a core group of five guys. I think we're like in the 500s now as far as the group goes. And it's an amazing organization because everybody comes from multiple walks of life, right? There's groups that are, you know, they're pilots and they've got a pilot group talking about citadels. We've got citadels. The pilot guys are talking to the citadel guys about, you know, how do we get landing strips at different locations? We've got guys that are talking about communication in contested, degraded, congested environments through ham radio and mesh tastics and Loran. And then you've got folks who are brand new to Bitcoin and they're part of the self-custody group. And there's a cadre there that is teaching, you know, the evolution of hot wallets to cold wallets, to single sig, to multi-sig, to UTXO management. So there's just an amazing growth within the Bitcoin veterans, all aligned along a similar mission of, you know, spreading Bitcoin, freedom money, freedom technology to a group of people who spent a large portion of their adult lives fighting and defending freedom.
Hey there, just a quick break and we'll be right back to the show. I wanted to spend a minute sharing with you how the Bitcoin Way helps individuals achieve self-custody and self-sovereignty over their money, their online life, and having a plan B as an individual. The Bitcoin Way can help you properly custody your Bitcoin using only air-gapped, open-source, Bitcoin-only hardware wallets. We help you set up and run your node. It doesn't matter if you're brand new to Bitcoin, if you've been in Bitcoin 10 years, there's a good chance that there's a gap in your self-custody setup, and we can help resolve that and give you confidence and peace of mind. When it comes to your online life, you are being tracked and watched and spied on by governments, by corporate interests all over the place. We can give you confidence that even logging onto Wi-Fi at your airport or at your local coffee shop, you are protecting yourself and remaining self-sovereign and private. Finally, if you want help adding to your passport repertoire, we've got a citizenship program whereby we establish temporary residency and walk you through the entire process, white glove service, boots on the ground through citizenship. It is important in a time of crazy economic and political upheaval that you have optionality when it comes to where you're going to live, reside, and spend your life. Check out thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free consult with the team to learn more about our services and understand how we can help you achieve full self-sovereignty.
Do you think on average, the Bitcoin narrative and the ethos of Bitcoin, do you think it resonates better or more easily, or is it more of an uphill battle when talking with veterans? Because it seems to me like it could be a mixed bag, right? Like you've got these folks who have committed so much time, energy, and resource to defending U.S. interests and fighting for U.S. interests. And part of those interests, you know, in like the typical mainstream worldview is protecting the dollar and dollar hegemony. At the same time, though, my sense of service members is, you know, typically, to kind of the point you were making, more self-sovereignty, property rights types of individuals. I feel like it could go either way. In general, what would you say? Is it easier or harder to get this message through to a military veteran?
I think that it depends on their willingness to learn. And I know that might sound like a cop-out to some of your listeners, but like I'd mentioned earlier, you know, we're battling 12, 13, 14 years of negative information on mainstream media. And so is the person who happened to wear the uniform and, you know, sign their name to the dotted line to be able to defend the, you know, the rights and freedoms of the United States or whatever country that they've served in the military. But are they willing to learn? And are they willing to unlearn what they thought they knew? And so it's a certain type of person. Yeah, it's a certain type of person. Like, for example, I know some folks who they might still be in the military or they've recently separated from the military as well, like I did last year, who are unwilling to, you know, crack open the book. They've seen that, you know, hey, it went down 80%. I, you know, it's funny. It was like a while back, a couple months back, I got a text message from a buddy of mine and he was like, there's no trust in Bitcoin. I don't know why you're committing to it. And then it was like, not even a couple weeks later and it was back to exactly where it was. I thought about gloating to him, but that's not in my DNA. So I didn't, I let it slide. But I think ultimately people who aren't willing to learn only see the negative. And, you know, when it's on a tear, it's not on their radar. And so I think that's the biggest challenge is how do you combat those decades of misinformation or just flat out false information and really start to open someone's eyes to, you know, the possibility of Bitcoin and all that it can do for this world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you're, I think that's a good answer. I mean, how willing are you to learn? Because I think that goes for anyone. I mean, I would say that pre-Bitcoin, that today my values still align very much with my pre-Bitcoin years. My opinions on particular events, institutions, you name it, have changed immensely, though, right? Like how I sort of take what I believe to be true and apply that to, you know, what I think makes sense in the world is very different. So, you know, I think what I've noticed is that in order to get Bitcoin, you have to at least be curious. And if you're just not curious and you're set in your ways and, you know, it's going to take you a lot longer. And I guess that's the, we all get Bitcoin at the price we deserve sort of thing. So, you know, no, that makes sense. So, hey, I want to shift topics because I've got a cybersecurity expert, a guy with a lot of experience here with me. And, man, we have seen some crazy, I don't think a lot of people appreciate just how crazy some of the crackdowns, like the assault on free speech is in full swing. You know, this is a war being waged against us. We've seen censorship in the UK. I mean, they're literally making room in prisons by sending violent criminals back out so they can put social media memers in behind bars. And, you know, the Telegram CEO and founder was arrested in France earlier this week. And at the same time, we're living in an age where we have optionality. And I think we're very fortunate to do so because I think 20 years ago, you're just in a lot of trouble. Would you like to comment on any one of those events or anything else that maybe I didn't mention? And then maybe kind of give your thoughts on like, where is this trend coming from? Like why now? Why the assault on free speech?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, wow. It's a wide topic. How much time do we have? I'm just kidding. Yeah. So the attacks on free speech in the UK, I think that it's appalling to me to watch from the outside looking in and I know for a fact, you know, not having been to the UK in many years, and I was only there for a couple of days on vacation, but from the outside looking in and not really understanding how bad or not bad it is, you know, we're shaped by the narrative that we see, whether it's on mainstream media or if it's, you know, alternative news sources like on Twitter or other areas. But I think the reality is there are some people who are making posts on social media that aren't aligned with the political landscape that they're in right now, and they're getting arrested. And I think that's a travesty to freedom. And I am deeply surprised by the number of people who just aren't paying attention to it. You know, I think all of us Bitcoiners, we're juggling, you know, 10 or 20 different messaging apps to different circles and different groups. And, you know, in one of these other groups, and I'll call them like my group of friends that I'm slowly trying to orange pill, I'll try to have these conversations with them. And it's like crickets, because they either aren't aware of it, or they're not willing to have, you know, that deeper level conversation about, you know, what is happening to personal freedom, not just in the US, but everywhere around the world in locations that people would assume are mostly free nations. And, you know, the censorship and the limiting of the freedom of speech is just absolutely appalling to watch in real time. One of the other ones that you'd mentioned is Pavel Durov, CEO of Telegram, his arrest. I think I saw this morning they're bringing him up on 12 different charges as far as facilitating, you know, communications. you know, I was having a conversation with my wife, and it's like, are they going to go arrest, you know, the CEO of Ford for all the drunk driving that's taking place on different vehicles? And I'm not trying to single out Ford, any automotive manufacturer, or, you know, they're going to go to Home Depot and confiscate all the hammers, or, you know, go to the store, and they're not. The reality is they're not. They've singled out this one particular person for whatever reason. And I've got some tinfoily hat-ish theories behind that. But yeah. And then, you know, the second order effect of that is I saw that Chris Pavlovsky, hopefully I'm pronouncing his name right, CEO of Rumble, he jumped on a jet and left Europe. I think his post on Twitter said 30 hours later, right? And so the arrest of the Telegram CEO, and now the CEO of Rumble is like, hey, I need to get out of Europe. I don't know what's going to happen because, oh, by the way, I provide a similar platform for video that spreads, you know, that gives people the opportunity to spread freedom around the world. So he left Europe. And then a little bit more Bitcoin specific, you know, Simply Bitcoin, one of, I would say one of the core news sources for a lot of Bitcoiners, they were just banned off of they were banned off of YouTube just a couple of days ago. And so we're seeing it in multiple different areas for multiple different reasons. The underlying truth is there is a wave of censorship coming that is trying to limit free speech. As Bitcoiners, and I'll kind of pause here, but as Bitcoiners, who have moved past just number go up and started looking towards freedom go up, those Bitcoiners already know that there are opportunities that exist today and emergent opportunities that are in development tomorrow that can limit that level of censorship and allow for continued freedom of speech.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, censorship coming to a jurisdiction near you is really like the path we're on. And my sense, I'd be curious to hear if you agree. My sense is the narrative is really the only, it's like that last thing that the powers that be, politicians, the IMF, whoever it is, it's the last thing they really control. And in the last couple of years, it's, I mean, they've lost control because you do have these, you know, Telegram, Signal, you've got, you know, love them or hate them, Elon Musk, I think they view as a threat with X, other open source protocols, obviously, that we'll touch on here. And then just, you know, folks like Joe Rogan who just kind of say what they think. And again, love them, hate them, you know, agree, disagree, doesn't really matter. This new like push toward independent media has completely spiraled their ability to maintain that narrative en masse. And it feels like they're just grasping, you know, at straws here, trying to do what they can. And my guess is really to coerce and scare a lot of these other founders, you know, the Rumble CEO getting out of Europe and, you know, 30 hours later, I think is a great image of what that looks like. And I think the question is, you know, will they be able to break some of these people and coerce them into, you know, giving up encryption keys, shutting down, whatever it is. They've already done that with some of the Bitcoin companies here in the US, some wallets and the Samurai guys. I think you could argue that's just an extension of the free speech that they're trying to take down. Is that sort of how you view all of these, like, circumstances?
Yeah, 100%. And actually, there was one that came out last night that I'll try to use as a vignette, right? So, Mark Zuckerberg, he released a letter last night to one of the senators about basically it was an admission of actions they took in 2020. Ish timeframe related to throttling information on the Facebook platform, censoring some levels of information. And so, you know, if I were to zoom out and I would say that, you know, the CEO of Facebook is admitting that they were pressured by the US government and the administration to do these actions to limit freedom of speech or to prevent the message getting out to the masses is an absolute infringement. And then you apply that to all of these others, you know, whether it's Telegram or Instagram or, like you said, Samurai, Wasabi, any of the little bit more Bitcoin focused areas. Yes, they're transactions, but that is a form of communication and a form of speech. And my personal opinion, I don't think that the government should be involved in censoring and throttling, you know, a person's legal right to be able to communicate and transact.
Yeah, I think that's a good position to take. So we've sort of hinted at some of these newer decentralized protocols for mitigating against the threat of censorship in our lives. Nostr, Keet is one we use for our communications. What are some of these tools that you're either actively using or you view as, you know, promising or perhaps the future of free speech and censorship resistant speech? And what sort of direction do you think that these new technologies are taking the world?
Yeah. So let me tie the previous conversation to this one. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it doesn't come off too tinfoil hatty. But no, I
personally don't have to worry about that here. you put your tinfoil hat on, man. You're welcome here.
But I find it interesting that the Telegram CEO is arrested, but the Facebook CEO is not. And, you know, they provide Facebook Messenger, which is on many people's phones, and people use it under the assumption or the guise of end-to-end encryption, right? So I find it interesting, and this is where the tinfoil hat comes in. Is it because one has not been coerced or co-opted by the government, aka the one whose CEO got arrested, and is one already been coerced or co-opted by the government, and that's why that particular CEO is not arrested, right? And so the problem that I see with those types of services, and we'll call them, you know, early end-to-end encrypted communications platforms, the problem I see with those is the centralization of servers, right? Just like we saw with Samurai as an example. You know, they take down Samurai, they get access to all of their servers, and whatever information or logs that hasn't been wiped is now, you know, safe to assume under government control. Could that also be done with all of these end-to-end encrypted platforms on centralized servers? So for me, the exploration then is, what are decentralized end-to-end encrypted services, either currently in use or emergent, that people can start to explore and research? And like you mentioned, I think that Nostr is one of those that is an excellent candidate. Keet, like you mentioned also, and we talked about off recording, is definitely another one. And then one that I've personally been researching is Simplex. And I think Simplex is extremely interesting, at least for me, because the relays, so it doesn't have centralized servers. It has relays very similar to Nostr, but those relays could be run on something like a Start9 node. And so that gives you a little bit more self-sovereignty in your communications, because you know that it's running through your relay and it's not going through some black hole centralized server that who knows what they're doing with the information that's traversing through those paths. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's one of those where people have to get comfortable trying different things and, you know, upgrading their security model. It's funny to me sometimes when, you know, we all have friends probably who every 1 or 2 years they're upgrading, you know, their phone to the newest, latest and greatest iPhone, or they're upgrading their car, or they're upgrading their TV to the newest thing, but they don't ever take the time to upgrade their security model. You know, they'll do hours of research on the newest Samsung TV versus the newest Sony TV and which one has the better picture and the better blacks. They'll spend hours doing that, but they won't spend 1 hour, you know, just assessing their security model and looking at how they can improve or where are the weak points, where are the choke points in their security model to make them a little bit more safer and sovereign in cybersecurity.
Yeah, man, what you're talking about here resonates, because that's a lot of what the Bitcoin way does besides self-custody is like online privacy, de-Googled phones. And then, you know, as an extension of that for the sovereign individual, you know, plan B options. So I'm curious. So I got to meet Matt Hill, who's CEO of Start9 in Nashville, and I had him on the podcast a while back before we'd met in person. And my sense of their vision is, you know, that one day everyone would run in their hopes a Start9, but some self-sovereign computing device in their home, where that's where they store their files. They're rolling out all sorts of cool new features, backups, and they've got a whole app store of open source tools that you can, you know, effectively plug into that and make better use of it. Is the way you see the world, and maybe this is like putting on your, you know, like your rose colored glasses, but is the way you see the world, you know, 20 years from now, that, you know, in best case, that everyone is running their own server, so to speak, but it's plug and play. It's very easy. It's intuitive, because obviously, like right now, you don't have to be a cypherpunk to use Start9, but you have to be an early adopter. You know, like I think you and I are probably anomalies compared to the general population. You know, most people I know would open that box and have no idea what to do with their own server, right? But someday could a tool like that be serve as a relay for Noster? And I don't know the underlying technology, I haven't dug into it, but like Keet, you know, a relay for Keet or Simplex, as well as this is where you host your files. You don't need to trust, you know, any of these big brother, big tech companies. Is that sort of the way that you envision the world going over time? Or do we need to feel more pain for us to get there? Or do you think we're going to kind of continue to revert back to sort of a trusted system where you've got a few big tech monopolies that hold everyone's information?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, if we zoom out, the pendulum, in this case, the pendulum certainly swings back and forth, right? You know, way back when we had mainframe computers, and then the pendulum kind of swung to personal computers, and the emergence of the internet, and the pendulum swung back to, you know, cloud services. And now I think kind of what you were alluding to, I think that pendulum is swinging back, and it's going to be, I don't want to host my information on an untrusted third party. Instead, I want to be able to host it on hardware that I control. And I think that that's going to be something like a Start9. You know, I think it was Naval Ravikant who said, look at what the nerds are doing today, because that's what everyone is going to be doing in 20 years. And I think that, you know, some people don't like the term, but I kind of embrace it. I think a lot of Bitcoiners are nerds, myself included. And, you know, when the Bitcoiners and the nerds of the world are exploring self-sovereign computing in their home, away from, you know, big tech and away from cloud service providers like Amazon or Microsoft or Google, and they're looking to host it themselves, I think that's an indicator that what the nerds are doing today is what everyone is going to do 20 years from now. Mm. So I think you're spot on.
Okay. All right. Let's get, as we start to round this out, let's get real practical. As someone who has a lot of cybersecurity experience, you've been in Bitcoin a while, what are key pieces of advice you'd give to like a normie or a Bitcoiner related to their personal privacy, security, and then maybe self-sovereignty more generally?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a daunting task, right? Because not every Bitcoiner is a cybersecurity expert, and certainly not every cybersecurity expert is a Bitcoiner. So really what you're looking for is an individual with a unique set of skills, appetite for information, appetite for learning. The other difficulty is, I usually like to give recommendations specific to the individual. I don't like to give general recommendations. But in this case, you know, I know that you've got listeners who are probably interested in this topic. So I'll try to hit a couple of the wave tops. This one is probably said too often. Hopefully it doesn't fall on deaf ears. But it's like strong passwords and don't reuse passwords is like the most basic baby step that you could take. I would even take it one step further and tell people to look at two-factor and multi-factor authentication and don't stop at just, you know, the Google Authenticator or the Microsoft Authenticator that's on your phone. And we don't have to get into the details of why that's not a great solution. It's certainly better than SMS. So don't use SMS for multi-factor authentication, but take one step further beyond just, you know, your software authenticator apps and look at things like a passkey, which was recently adopted by Google and many others, service providers of, you know, tools like Gmail that a lot of people probably use. So look at something like a passkey, or take it one step even further and look at a hardware key like a YubiKey. I'd like to draw this analogy that if you're using a hardware wallet to secure your Bitcoin, you should probably use air-gapped hardware for your passwords or for your two-factor authentication. And for me, that's something like a YubiKey from YubiKey. So that's a bare bones minimum, right? The next thing, and I know that this isn't for everyone, but is to start looking at your data path and what are the nodes along that data path where you impart trust to that particular third party. So, you know, coming out of your house, that might look like your internet service provider. What are you trusting from your internet service provider? The one that people outside of cybersecurity channels probably don't know is your DNS or your domain name server, right? Anytime you go into a browser and you type Google, you're not actually going to google.com. You're sending google.com to a DNS. That DNS is going to reply back with your IP address, the IP address of the destination you're trying to go to. So you're trusting your DNS or everything that you search on the internet to your ISP. What if your ISP is providing you malicious or bad IP addresses that you have to connect to? So that is one of the trust areas that you are imparting to your ISP. And then from there, what's next? You know, are you connecting to social media? How much information do you have shared with social media? Or, you know, are you doing geographic lookups on maps.google.com? Really, it's just to follow that data path of what you do on a regular basis. And then where you impart that level of trust to those things. And then once you've done that assessment, the next step is, okay, what can you do to protect or mitigate the level of trust that you've assigned to those nodes within that path? So one of the things that I like to tell people as far as DNS is you don't have to use your ISP's DNS. You know, Cloudflare has an open third-party DNS that they say they don't log. Google has one. There are a number of opportunities. I think it's like 1.1.1, 8.8.8, quad nines. People can go out there and kind of Google it. So you take that level of trust away from the ISP. The other one is, okay, if you've done that, well, your ISP might still be able to see the traffic that's traversing along that line because you have to use them. So again, you might have other opportunities here. Bitcoiners are very familiar with tools like VPNs and with Tor as a way to either anonymize the traffic that is being moved or to obfuscate, encrypt the traffic. And so really it's if Bitcoiners are willing to show the proof of work that they've studied the underlying technology, it's also worthwhile to show the proof of work that they've gone through and they've assessed, you know, their security model, where they place trust in third parties, and then what can they do to mitigate those levels of trust?
Yeah, Great answer. Alrighty, last one for you. This is one I ask everyone just for fun. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if it's unpopular, even amongst Bitcoiners?
Wow. So I know this is popular or unpopular with Bitcoiners, because, you know, we've all drank the Kool-Aid, and, you know, Bitcoin is the exit strategy. And I believe that 100%. But at the same token, I think everybody has to live their life, right? People who've been in Bitcoin for a long time, they've evolved over those 4, those 8, or those 6, or those 2 years. You know, many of them probably started off a single person with very little responsibilities. And over that time, they've grown up. They have a significant other. They may have kids in that equation now, or they're still in a studio apartment stacking like psychos, right? But eventually you've got to live your life as well. So I will say that, you know, one opinion that I have is to have some form of exit strategy. And that is certainly not to say sell your whole stack, because you'd be an idiot to do that. And I'd be a dumbass if I told people to do that. But have a number in mind where, and have a goal. Don't just sell to go into fiat. I think that's dumb too. But if it's to get out of that studio apartment and get into, you know, a new home for, you know, your growing family, or your car is running on duct tape and fumes, and you really need to get to, you need a vehicle to get reliably to work every day, have a goal in mind, and then have a target for a small allocation percentage exit strategy to improve your life. I think that, you know, a lot of people will say, especially in the public eye, never sell your Bitcoin. I'm never going to sell my Bitcoin. I'm dying on this hill. But I think the reality is, there are situations where it is okay, and you don't have to justify that sell to anyone except yourself. And so, but if you don't have a plan in place beforehand, you're probably going to make a mistake. And so have a plan, have a goal, have a target. And if it's going to be life-changing for you, sell your Bitcoin and don't feel bad about that. That'd be my opinion. I know that, at least for me, I've got some long-term goals on how I think it could be life-changing for me and my family and my kids and my kids' kids. And so that's kind of where my mindset is. And I think that everybody has to have that longer term, you know, low tide preference view for when they would sell their Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great opinion to have. I think the good thing is that I think there are two pieces of the equation. So one, I think the good thing about Bitcoin is it incentivizes better decisions around how you use it, because it is scarce and you recognize the extreme value of this thing that you hold, that I don't think most people who understand Bitcoin to begin with will waste it. But I think there is still sort of an intense pressure from the community, so to speak, that you never use it. You die with it. And it's like, yeah, like, you can't take it with you, and you've got one life to live. And, if you got kids and a family, I think the importance of, using it wisely and not just storing it wisely, I think, is magnified. So I think that's a good hot take, and one that I can't disagree with. So I know we'll probably get some flack for agreeing on that, but I think that's just part of the deal, man. Adrian, man, thank you so much for taking some time. Really enjoyed the conversation. You are a wealth of knowledge, and it was a blast getting to hang out with you in person. I'm glad we got to do this here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I still think back on that day. We were at a Anders pleb party, and I saw you, you saw me, but we weren't sure if we were each other. And so we started to kicked off that conversation, and I'm super humbled and glad that we had that opportunity. And then we bumped into each other again in the conference hall and had some great conversations. So I think it was great, and I look forward to catching up with you more in person.
Yeah, man. So much fun. Glad we got to, and glad we got to do this as well. Thanks so much again. And cheers, brother. We'll talk soon.
All right. We'll see you.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I forgot at the very end of the episode to ask Adrian for a handoff and to share where you can find him. I think in talking with him, the best place is probably on Twitter, X, whatever you're calling it, and it's his name. So it's at Adrian Cercenia, C-E-R-C-E-N-I-A. And I think he said his pinned tweet is his NPub for Noster. So if you want to find him there, he's obviously using that more and more frequently. As always, thank you for tuning in. If you want to learn more about the Bitcoin Way, go schedule a call with the team, thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We help with self-custody. We help with online privacy and security, really a lot of what we were talking about in this conversation today, and Plan B, residency to citizenship options as well. So again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We'd love to talk with you and hope to see you there. Until next time, this is Michael signing off.